Hello and welcome back to the shortest history of Britain. In this episode, we're going to be dealing with the 11th century, so the 1000s, the period of time between the turn of the first millennium, so the year 1000, and the year 1100. As always, there's so much to fit into so little time, so let's get started. If we look back to where we left off at the end of episode 2, the Danish had successfully invaded Britain in the year 1015, and their king, Canute the Great, had successfully claimed control of the land, installing himself as king and ruler of all England. Now, Ethelred the Unready, who was the king of England at the time prior to this invasion, had fallen back with his people to London, and on his death was then succeeded by his son Edmund. So as Canute and his Danish forces had pushed inland, Edmund met him in battle, and an agreement was formed between the two of them to split the country, the rulership of the country, into two, with Edmund ruling Wessex and Canute ruling all of the rest. If we remember, if we look back, the country had been split into these seven different ruling kingdoms, Wessex being one of them. So 2 years later, so we're looking at the year 1017 now, Edmund was found dead in very mysterious circumstances. So we're assuming here that this was at the hands of one of Canute's assassins. And on the announcement of his death, the English council, which was known as the Witan, the political institution which was made of members of the ruling class, so there'd have been noblemen, men of the clergy, and they would advise the king on certain matters. So this council proclaimed that Canute was now the king of all of England. Now, there's a very messy swapping of power at this time, and it does get very confusing to go into in too much detail. But I'm going to try to give you the quick rundown. Apologies if this gets confusing, try to bear with me. So Canute had called for Edmund, who of course was now dead, had called for Edmund's widow. And he asked her to marry him on the agreement that he would only hand his succession on his own death to children born from her, and not to those who had been born to his previous wife, who was of Danish descent. However, when Canute died in 1035, the succession of the English crown was disputed between Harthacnut Canute, who was his son to Edmund's widow, who was named Emma, and Harold, who was his son to his first wife, the Danish wife. There was a mess of legal and political wranglings around this, and eventually Harold was made the king, though this only lasted 5 years until his own death, at which point Harthacnut was then made king, and this was the son of Canute and Emma, Edmund's widow. Now Harthacnut had a bad reputation amongst the people of Britain, especially for imposing high taxes, and he was so reviled amongst the people that Edward, who was Ethelred the Unready's son, was invited back from his exile in Normandy to take over the power. And so a year later, Harthacnut was found dead, again presumably murdered, and Edward, Ethelred the Unready's son, who would go on to be known as Edward the Confessor, was crowned. Now I told you it would get a bit confusing, so don't worry if you couldn't keep up with that. There's always the benefit of a rewind button. Now, Edward the Confessor reigned until 1065, when the crown was passed to Harold Godwinson, who was known as Harold II. So this is a different Harold. Harold II's father and his family, the House of Godwin, had been very close to the royals, themselves a very prominent family of noblemen in the country. Though others had also declared themselves the next king of England. You had Harold Hardrada. Apologies, that's another Harold. Harold Hardrada of Norway, known as Harold the Ruthless. He claimed that he'd made an arrangement with Canute and with Harthacnut to take the crown some years prior. Now also you had William, who was Duke of Normandy, who it's believed had been promised the succession by Edward before his death, though again a lot of it was hearsay. So there's this clashing of these power figures from around England and from around the neighbouring countries, and it was all poised to break wide open. So Tostig, who was Harold's somewhat estranged brother, was the first to move on this. He travelled to Normandy to enlist the help of William, Duke of Normandy, who would go on to be known as William the Conqueror. Now, William wasn't ready at the time, and through one means or another, and there are conflicting theories as to exactly what did happen here, Tostig ended up linking up with Harald Hardrada from Norway, and pushing into Scotland and into the River Tyne in the northeast. They moved south to York, and King Harald of England met them at battle at Stamford Bridge on the Derwent in East Riding of Yorkshire, eventually defeating the invaders and allowing them to freely leave the shores in a fleet of ships, perhaps 20 ships is the estimate. That very night, as the English were celebrating their victory at Stamford Bridge, William of Normandy sailed his fleet across the Channel to England. They made land in Pevensey, though a few ships had been blown off course, landed in Romney, and made a small fort in Pevensey and marched to Hastings, where they made another fort, and set about raiding the local area. So King Harold, who was up in Yorkshire, marched his men back south again, and the two forces met in battle just outside of Hastings, a week or so probably later. Now, the exact number of men on each side of the battle is really unknown. It's thought that there would have possibly been between 5,000 and maybe 12 or 13,000 troops in the invading Norman army, and probably only around 7 or 8,000 on the English side. So the English army at that time would have been made up of largely infantry. There wouldn't have been many horses in battle. They would have been wearing a form of chainmail suit. They would have worn that very iconic conical helmet, which rises up into a cone at the top. They would have had a sword, a shield. Some would have carried two-handed axes, war axes, battle axes. As I say, most would have had the sword too. There would have been archers, and there would have been men with javelins and spears. So quite late into the battle, the Battle of Hastings, obviously as we know it, King Harold was killed on the battlefield. Now, it's not quite clear how. We often turn to the Bayeux Tapestry for the kind of illustrated version of the events. This was completed in 1077, so a decade or so later. But the line on the tapestry that reads, "Here King Harold has been killed," has been embroidered above two figures. Now, one's been killed on the ground with a sword, and one, slightly more famously, holding the arrow from his eye. Now, it's not clear which one of these is meant to depict Harold, if either, or perhaps both. Despite nobody knowing who killed Harold, as it happened in the wild melee of battle, it is entirely possible that whilst wounded to the eye, he was then struck with a sword. So again, we're never likely to know this, really. Regardless, the king was dead, and William of Normandy, William the Conqueror, sometimes William the Bastard, as he was born of an affair, claimed victory over the English. And so he rode to London, moving through the Chilterns, along the Thames. The English leaders largely submitted to him at this point, and he was crowned in Westminster Abbey, which was Edward the Confessor's new church, on Christmas Day of 1066. And so we turn the page into a new chapter of British history, which was the Norman rule, the House of Normandy. So William was a brutal ruler. He took to consolidating power across the land, though it would take him nearly a decade. in a particularly brutal process, which was known as the Harrying of the North, William ordered the complete destruction of the Northern Territories, burning crops, burning livestock, and then poisoning the earth so that nothing more could grow. It's reported that about 100,000 people died of starvation as a result of this harrying, as they call it, which at the time was around 1 in 20 of the overall population of the country. In places, 75% of the population either died or fled the land and never returned to it. Now, one of the biggest mass exoduses of these people occurred in around 1070, when a huge group of these Anglo-Saxons left in a fleet of around 240 ships and sailed out to the Byzantine Empire, or the Eastern Roman Empire, also Byzantium. And what we're talking about here when we're referring to the Eastern Roman Empire, it's this continuation of the since failed Roman Empire as we know it on these eastern provinces. So coming out from Italy, across through Greece and Romania, and down into Turkey. In fact, Constantinople, which is Istanbul today, was the capital of this empire. And then, of course, it sunk down into Egypt and came back along the north coast of Africa through Tunisia and the coasts of Algeria and Morocco. And the empire actually became a popular destination for many of these kind of Englishmen who had fled, especially the nobles, soldiers, men with military background. The Byzantines were in need of mercenaries. They were in need of men to continue their empire. And the English became eventually a predominant element in this elite force of personal bodyguards and mercenaries. So until then, it had been largely made of Norsemen, these Scandinavian and Danish soldiers, acting as the emperor's bodyguards. But after this mass migration, these Anglo-Saxons from England actually began to become the, as I say, the predominant makeup of this force. And they began to settle along the Black Sea coastline and actually establish towns there in the region called New London and New York, obviously long before the New York that we know of now. Now, the north, as it were, consisted of what is now Lancashire, Yorkshire, Durham, Northumberland, and then the southerly parts of Cumberland and Westmoreland too. So this great suppression of any opposition to the Norman rule led to the construction of many new castles. Generally, they would have been of the Mott and Bailey style. These included the White Tower, at what is now the Tower of London, and a new castle on the River Tyne, which would be the site of Newcastle. We see the construction of some of the first real stone castles across the land. So as William pushed around the country on this great genocide that he were enacting, he oversaw the construction of grand castles as he went. So the people of England were so unhappy with their Norman ruler that opposition was springing up around the country in attempts to overthrow the king and the Norman rule. These castles were built in some respects to protect him and his army and his people from the people he actually governed. In 1068 alone, the Normans constructed the castles at Exeter, Nottingham, Warwick, and these are incredible structures. York, Cambridge, Huntingdon, Lincoln, and this is all in the same year. This is all in 1068. The following year, Chester and Stafford. The year after that, Ely. Then Durham. If we look at the Domesday Book, we see 36 castles constructed by or under the command of William of Normandy, King William the First, during this time. And actually, if we look at those constructed under the command of his subordinates, then that number's actually greatly increased. So not long after this, the Normans pushed west into Wales and created a castle and fort on the site of an old Roman settlement that had previously stood, which was Cardiff. And so it's thought that these castles served certainly more than a royal purpose, but also more than the military purpose too. They were positioned to command road and river routes through the country, so as to give the Normans this command over trade too, so that goods that passed were able to be controlled and monitored by the Normans. And then beyond that, they also served as a show of power to the people. So you have to imagine that they would have been the highest and the grandest buildings for miles and miles around. So they're a very physical demonstration of the king's power. Now, in places like Colchester, the great tower there was almost certainly of no strategic or military value, but was built incredibly tall and quite majestic. It was also, very tellingly, built over the top of the existing Roman temple that had stood there, almost as a show that the Normans, that William the First, was an equal ruler to the Roman leaders themselves, in this case Julius Caesar. So William the First had his own scribe, his own biographer, called William of Poitiers. And he was keen to repeatedly point out the connections between William the First and Julius Caesar. And so it seems that if we look at the towers that the Norman ruler built in places like Colchester or the White Tower in London, that this was indeed an image that William was very keen to create and to reinforce for himself. Now, in 1086, so William's been in power for two full decades now, and then into the couple of years that followed that as well, William began to draw up the Domesday Book, the first attempt to document the ownership and the value of all the owned land in the country. Essentially, it was a way to determine what taxes were still owed or unpaid since the rule of Edward the Confessor, and to reassert this power of the crown back over the land. It was written in medieval Latin, which was the language of the time. It also formed quite a large part of this new transition from what was a largely oral style of documentation until that point into a more written form. For those interested, it can actually be viewed at the National Archives in Kew in London. Now, a decade later, in 1097, William, Duke of Normandy, William the Conqueror, died and passed the throne to his son, William the Second, or William the Red, William Rufus, it would have been in Latin. Each of the sons of William of Normandy had been given land, some back in Normandy, some in England. And William the Second, William the Red, who was actually his third child, was given the English crown. But Henry, who was his fourth son, was left landless as part of this deal, and actually had to purchase a part of Normandy from one of his brothers so that he could hold land of his own. And so when Henry joined William II on a hunting trip, William II was hit by an arrow and killed in rather suspicious circumstances, which may or may not point to his murder. And so Henry swiftly claimed the English crown, and the 11th century came to a close with the crowning of Henry as Henry I of England in Westminster Abbey. So a tumultuous century filled with murder and the passing of the rulership of England between various nations, with Henry being the final ruler of the House of Normandy. Next time, we look at the 1100s. We see the end of the Norman rule and the beginning of the Plantagenet kings, the Great Crusades, and Richard the Lionheart.